This is episode 3 of the podcast. If you haven't yet listened to episode 2, check that out first. We'll meet you back here. Former Pittsburgh Mayor Tom Murphy loves to tell the kidnapping story.
I call the mayor of Atlanta and I say, tell me about the two guys at a Home Depot.
Arthur Blank and Bernie Marcus.
And he said, Bernie Marcus, particularly very philanthropic and very active in national Jewish affairs.
Tom called up a few friends in Pittsburgh's Jewish community, and he asked them to invite Bernie Marcus to dinner. They did. The night of the party, everything was going well. People were chatting.
And my bodyguard and I walk up to Bernie Marcus and said, we're kidnapping you. And he shows him his gun. And Bernie Marcus says, what is this about? I said, you can make our dreams come true if you come with us for a half hour.
It was 1998. Tom Murphy had just been reelected as mayor of Pittsburgh, and he desperately wanted a Home Depot in East Liberty. He thought it was the key to revitalize the neighborhood. But Home Depot's real estate people had already said, thanks, not interested. When they put Bernie Marcus in the car and drove through East Liberty, he kind of had the same response. But Tom had a lot of practice helping people see not what Pittsburgh was, but what it could be.
And so at the end of the evening, he came up and said, we'll take a risk with you. We'll put a store here.
It's hard to overstate how major this victory was for Tom. He and his administration had spent the previous 4 years buying a lot of land in Pittsburgh, and they needed something to show for it. The way Tom saw it, Home Depot was East Liberty's golden ticket back to prosperity.
I mean, East Liberty was largely a wasteland.
From 90.5 WESA, this is Land and Power. Who has it, what they do with it, and how that shapes the cities around us. I'm Margaret J. Krause. The kidnapping Mayor Tom Murphy staged in 1998 set off a string of events that changed East Liberty forever. City leaders have enormous power. The decisions they make reverberate for generations. Today, how the attitudes and actions of three different Pittsburgh mayors, Tom Murphy included, set the stage for the showdown over Penn Plaza. First up, Mayor David L. Lawrence. David Lawrence took office in 1946. Pittsburgh was gutted by 100 years of industry. The rivers overflowed with pollution. So much smoke and grit filled the air, the streetlights came on before noon. The Wall Street Journal called Pittsburgh a Class D city and didn't expect it to recover. People wanted out. A booming economy meant money to buy new cars, to drive down big new highways, and away. More and more people chose to work in Pittsburgh, but live outside it. The GI Bill covered the down payment on a lot of new suburban homes. Social psychiatrist Dr. Mindy Fullilove has researched how cities responded to those changes. And she says at the time, there was another federal policy from the 1930s eating away at neighborhoods.
The redlining process.
Mortgage agents declared black and integrated neighborhoods the most risky, the least valuable. And they colored them red on federal maps, hence the name, redlining.
Neighborhoods don't become distressed by themselves. Neighborhoods become distressed because our society structures who gets money.
Redlining pushed communities into a tailspin. City officials started to call them blighted. And this is important, because in 1949, a new federal law came along and said, hey, cities, if you declare blight, you can tear the place down, and we'll foot most of the bill. This was urban renewal.
But there has to be something that people see to justify mass destruction.
Mayor David Lawrence basically spread his arms and said, here's the justification all around you. He saw deteriorating housing and a dwindling white middle class, and he reached for urban renewal like a drowning person grasps at a buoy. He knew he had to take bold action to save Pittsburgh. First, he tore down part of a neighborhood called Hazelwood on the banks of the Monongahela River to expand a steel mill. Then, at the very tip of downtown, where the three rivers meet, he cleared 59 acres of factories and homes to make way for a park and a bunch of office towers. Accolades poured in. But Mindy Fullilove can't shake a photo of Pittsburgh's brain trust from that time. The mayor, the civic and business leaders.
60-year-old white men, a whole bunch of them, like the corporate power of Pittsburgh, and nobody else. Not any women, not any people of color.
When that crew looked around Pittsburgh, Mindy says they looked with their biases. The areas they targeted for urban renewal were almost exactly the same places that federal mortgage agents colored red on their maps in the 1930s. Places where black people lived, places where immigrants lived. It informed their next move. They tore down 100 acres of a predominantly black neighborhood right on the edge of downtown called the Hill District. The Hill District still hasn't recovered. You'll hear about that later. For now, we're going to follow the bulldozers to where they rolled next. East Liberty. In the 1960s, new highways and new shopping malls threatened to sink East Liberty and its bustling Main Street. Alan Jacobs was one of the planners tasked with the neighborhood's overhaul.
We were in competition with the suburbs. Cities were better places, I thought. Good, strong centers and a fairly good density.
A lot of people worried that urban renewal would ruin the neighborhood. They packed public meetings. But some of East Liberty's biggest merchants figured the only way to survive was to beat the suburbs at their own game. People wanted new buildings, new roads. Urban renewal could do that.
It would be a good place to live, and that the center would be active.
City leaders acquired 254 acres full of houses and businesses in East Liberty and leveled about half. They demolished the traditional street grid. They closed the center of the neighborhood to cars, and instead, a new four-lane ring road took people to a series of giant parking lots. Five brand new apartment complexes, including Penn Plaza, replaced those blocks of homes. But it was too little too late, or too much too late, or the wrong thing entirely. By 1970, only half of the businesses were still in business. By the 1990s, it had gotten worse. More businesses closed. The neighborhood struggled. This brings us to our second mayor, who you met at the beginning of the episode, Tom Murphy. I met Tom Murphy in a city park last spring. He was just as enchanted by the setting.
Look at this squirrel.
As he was with the details of Pittsburgh's comeback.
How to create a new generation of employment, right?
Tom grew up in the South Side. He went into the Peace Corps and fell in love with how communities work. His master's thesis analyzed urban renewal. He says it was well-meaning, but a failure, here and everywhere else.
Sort of destruction of what we would think as vibrant communities. And they picked the wrong horse.
Tom took office on the heels of two enormously popular mayors, Dick Caligiuri and Sophie Maslow. They steered the city in its darkest hour and helped lay the foundation for a knowledge economy.
Professionals who make their living in medicine, education, industry, and technology.
By 1994, those industries provided hope for a brighter future. But Pittsburgh still faced a death spiral of fewer people, less tax revenue, and not enough reasons to stick around. Tom thought he had to remake Pittsburgh, and the plan had to be bold.
It was sort of this no guts, no glory, take no prisoners kind of approach. And so we decided we needed, to be successful, we needed money, land control, and sophisticated deal-making capacity.
Okay, that last part sounds kind of boring, but this is pure city swashbuckling. Here's how it actually worked. First things first, money. There wasn't much. So what could make money?
I thought the universities could be the economic drivers of Pittsburgh. But there's no infrastructure. There's no serious money in Pittsburgh. There's no venture capital to speak of, right?
They convinced a few people in town to set up venture capital funds. The plan was to convert good ideas at the universities into startup companies and provide them funding so they'd stay in town and create new jobs.
And so now there was money and people were looking for deals, right?
This approach helped seed Pittsburgh's robotics industry. But the city still needed to draw new people and new development to Pittsburgh. How? They looked at the city budget. They decided they could slice off $6 million a year. And instead of fixing sidewalks or ball fields, they signed up for a new piece of debt. They took out a $60 million bond issue to create a development fund. Second, land control.
That's a huge power.
Because if the city owns the land, they get to say how it's used. Murphy took the rest of that $60 million and went to the head of the city's redevelopment agency.
Buy everything you can buy with this money that we've now given you.
With money and land, Murphy believed the city could offer deals to real estate investors that they couldn't refuse. For instance, the city could pay to clean up old industrial sites so developers wouldn't have to.
So we buy Somerset.
A former dump site, now home to very expensive, very occupied homes.
We buy Southside Works.
A shopping district. built on the site of the old steel mill where Tom's dad worked.
We buy with the idea that we're going to use this as catalytic developments to begin to change Pittsburgh.
In total, Murphy's administration bought 1,500 acres, nearly 5% of the city's land. That would be like if New York City one day bought up all of Manhattan to redevelop.
Where does this idea and certainty that if you develop X, you will see Y? Like, where does that idea come from?
It's a big risk. We don't know. We don't know if anybody's going to show up.
But they had to try. Tom worried that if Pittsburgh didn't reinvent itself, it would just wither away.
The demands to spend your money all on today, getting the streets paved, hiring more police, doing this and that, you can do that, but the long term, your city will be successful if you take some of those resources and invest them in tomorrow.
In 1999, East Liberty captured Tom's attention.
We have the two poorest neighborhoods on one side of East Liberty and the two richest neighborhoods on the other side of East Liberty. And none of them are going to East Liberty right now to do anything.
With the right investments, Tom thought he could jumpstart a whole section of the city.
I mean, East Liberty was largely a wasteland. It was mostly vacant land.
Well, if you don't see black people, then yeah.
That's Justin Strong. In 1999, he was looking for a place to open a music venue, Shadow Lounge. Tom says people lived in East Liberty. There were stores.
But there was sort of no vision for the area.
Justin Strong wasn't a city planner, but he had a vision. While Tom chased Home Depot, Justin used the cash advance on his American Express card to rent a building in East Liberty.
Don't ever do that. It's a fun story now. My credit score is back up, so I'm all right.
East Liberty was one of the places you went. Essentially, you try to be down.
Daniel Lavelle is a city councilor now. As a young man, he saw what Justin saw in East Liberty.
Thriving, mostly African-American focused. Commercial district, walking down Penn Avenue, you had the stores, and then you had all the brothers with the tables out selling everything else. The bootleg tapes and the bootleg CDs, African-centered books.
Baina Brooken's family opened a store in the neighborhood in 1995 called Jamil's Global Village. Her dad started out as one of the vendors along Penn Avenue.
I guess the newcomers probably, you know, forget that there was like a thriving community that was there. You know, there used to be like East Liberty Alive, which was like a block party, spoken word, you know, rappers, people doing breakdancing, all different type of performances.
It's almost like after urban renewal, some people just stopped paying attention to the neighborhood. People moved out, stores closed, crime, and crucially, the perception of crime went up. But for lots of people, East Liberty continued to be home or a destination.
My name is Alethea Sims.
In the 1970s, Alethea remembers East Liberty as a kind of teenage paradise.
I could go shopping, or I could take a bus and go someplace else. Growing up in a very strict Christian household, I didn't go to clubs or parties or anything like that, so.
East Liberty was a place to be your own person. She even moved to the neighborhood a few years later, in the early 1980s. She and her mom lived in a building called East Mall. In the late 1980s, Crystal Jennings remembers a real feeling of community. Everyone looked out for everyone else. There were cookouts and Easter egg hunts. She credits the start of her track career to the long parking lot at her apartment complex, East Liberty Gardens.
Every weekend, people were knocking on my doors. Can Crystal come out? We have a group of people who want to race her.
Ime Alaquiva played a lot of basketball with his cousin there. He says East Liberty glowed.
I remember East Liberty coming off to me as a vibrant painting. The more I went there, the more this picture came to life because of the people, the energy, and the frequency that was in that section.
In 2001, Ime opened a music production studio called Your Mom's House, one floor above Shadow Lounge.
It was only one room. I had an old computer that was donated to me. The ceiling was put together by a gentleman. He charged me a buffalo chicken hoagie from Capri Pizza.
That same year, Jamie Wallace opened the city's first Ethiopian restaurant around the corner from Shadow Lounge. His friend Justin Strong told him the building was for sale, and Jamie bought it.
What I realized early on was if I were to rent as opposed to own, then I couldn't control my destiny.
These couple of blocks, Shadow Lounge, Your Mom's House, Abai Ethiopian Cuisine, Jamil's Global Village, they created their own gravitational pull. Justin Strong says it was amazing.
You used to be able to drive by on a Monday night or a Wednesday night, you'll hear music. Latin band playing, you'll hear jazz coming out the door. All that vibration just attracts people, and when it's positive vibrations, it feeds people's soul.
Just a half mile away, there was another orbit at work, with Home Depot at the center. Its gravitational pull drew in other big retailers, Whole Foods, a bookstore, a pharmacy, restaurants. This was the expanding solar system of development Larry Gumbrick saw that made him reconsider the future of Penn Plaza. Meanwhile, three of the neighborhood's big apartment complexes from the 1960s were going to be sold. More than 1,000 people lived there. It made Alethea Sims nervous.
We started hearing rumors.
She and a lot of other people anticipated that this would happen. They'd even formed a coalition in the mid-90s to ensure that if the buildings did sell, they'd be able to stay in East Liberty.
One of the things that really irked me was someone from the housing authority that was going to be in charge of us relocating or whatever. Her thing was like, you know, when you go, you'll just get to a new community, you'll start all over again. Maybe you don't want to.
Let's take a short break. We'll be right back.
Americans are grappling with a huge question right now. Can we trust the cops?
These are the different reasons people were put on the list. Falsifying reports or records.
What if I told you that in states all across the country,
issuance of unlawful orders,
there are lists that could tell you if individual cops were trustworthy.
Obedience to laws and policies.
These lists can draw a straight line from an officer's name to past misconduct. The problem is, there's a good chance you're not allowed to see them.
To turn a blind eye is basically saying, well, I hope the justice system works. That's not good enough for me.
I'm Jason Moon. From New Hampshire Public Radio, Document, Season 1, The List. A podcast about one state's decades of secrecy around police misconduct. Binge all the episodes now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Except for Penn Plaza, all of the big urban renewal era apartment buildings in East Liberty closed. Tom Murphy and the East Liberty Development Group worked to build replacement housing, where people with a lot of money and people with a little money lived together. It was what the East Liberty Community Plan envisioned. To the solar system of small business owners, it felt like things were shifting, fast. Justin Strong remembers a white couple who walked past Shadow Lounge a decade after they opened.
Poked their head in, we got a little happy hour going, oh man, this is nice. When did you guys open up? Like 2000. There's always this Columbus syndrome discovery that is very American. You take over the native population and then you impose your vision on it.
Jamie Wallace remembers the phone ringing and ringing at his restaurant, Abai. They were busy. Some of the callers would say they'd heard great things.
But it seems like it's in a sketchy location. And so they'd want to know, is it safe? Say if we don't ever have any issues here, it's great. That's a great block. Also, though, people would literally ask the question, are there a lot of Black people?
One day, Ime got a letter.
We no longer wish to renew your lease.
Your mom's house made music. Sometimes they were loud. So he says that may have been part of it. But everyone around him seemed to be getting letters too.
There was an economic ecosystem turn that went from mostly all Black and brown entrepreneurs to those Black and brown entrepreneurs getting kicked out of their places.
The word gentrification has become shorthand for so many things that it can feel meaningless. Even social scientists and economists have a hard time agreeing on how to define and measure it. But when sociologist Ruth Glass coined the term in 1964, she was talking specifically about the displacement of lower-income residents by higher-income residents. We can't definitively say that's what happened in East Liberty, but we do know that between 2009 and 2018, the neighborhood became wealthier and more educated. In the same time period, East Liberty lost nearly a quarter of its Black population. Jamie Wallace owned his building, but by 2013, he was ready to move on, and he closed. He says race played an important part in the changes in East Liberty, but it wasn't all about race.
There's a component to it that's just about market dynamics.
Justin Strong puts it this way.
Your most valuable land is in your most impoverished neighborhood.
It's business. Buy low, sell high.
You know, you want to be able to get a big swath of land to develop a vision for your target demo that you see fit.
Ultimately, in the contest between two adjacent solar systems, small businesses and big, that cluster of small businesses lost. By 2015, Abai was gone. Your mom's house was gone. Shadow Lounge had closed. The memory of the high-rises and business closures was still really fresh. Then, news of Penn Plaza broke.
There comes a time when people say enough.
Our third mayor rode a similar sentiment into office. Bill Peduto took the reins in 2014 from an administration that embroiled the city in corruption and scandal. Plus, the finances still weren't great. There was a sense that Bill needed to restore faith in government and in Pittsburgh's potential. In his inaugural speech, Bill Peduto declared that what makes a city honest makes it successful.
The politics that undermine growth, corruption, self-dealing, and disregard for the common good are the very ones that doom a city to economic failure. Good government isn't only a question of civic virtue, it is the thing that determines a city's survival.
Like Tom Murphy, Bill Peduto is a policy wonk. And his right-hand man, the guy who was going to bring this vision of virtue and growth to reality, was Kevin Acklin. He's a wonk in his own right.
We have a city that for the first time in 30 years is growing, modestly. The charge is that making sure that everybody shares in that growth, and there's no rule book for that, especially in this town. We're still operating on economic models that were built in 1945.
Kevin's an interesting mix of practical and idealistic. He's the third generation in his family to work for city government. He understands how the sausage is made. But at school, he studied political philosophy. In an interview before Peduto took office, Kevin told WESA he often rereads Machiavelli or Plato's Republic.
Nothing has changed in politics from, you know, the antiquity.
But this is the thing that really caught my ear. For every department head, Kevin bought a book called Prayer for the City by Buzz Bissinger. It's about Philadelphia in the 1990s, during the Ed Rendell administration, when that city was broke and struggling.
It is an instructive book because it shows how powerful the mayor can be. It's the closest thing to wearing a cape.
And in Pittsburgh, Kevin says the mayor has another advantage.
We're sort of a big, small town. When we do things, people take notice. But we're also a town where you can get all the decision makers in a room.
When the Peduto administration took office, they faced a significant challenge. Since the 1980s, Pittsburgh had ridden this pretty steady rise in investment. But the playbook was for city officials to go out and coax people to build stuff. They mostly directed developers to just a few places, near the universities, near downtown. They helped make the numbers work. Until one day, people didn't always need the city. There was a market, but it was uneven. Hotspots were right next to places that were still struggling. By the time Bill Peduto took office, developers started to see opportunity in some of those neighborhoods too, the places that hadn't been built up, that weren't prepared to absorb a lot of change all at once. This was a new paradigm. How do you encourage development but not get pancaked by it? None of the institutions inherited by Bill Peduto and his administration offered the answers, but they knew that if they were going to ensure everyone could share in Pittsburgh's growth, they needed to be active.
A new way to do business in Pittsburgh, that you were going to put people first.
Then came Penn Plaza.
There were notices being posted on people's doors, eviction notices at Penn Plaza, and I candidly wasn't aware what was happening.
Kevin and Mayor Bill Peduto felt blindsided, upset.
So traditionally, if somebody wants to do a development, they'll set up a meeting with the mayor, they'll set up a meeting with a council member, county executive, just to make us aware if they're were going to be problems, community problems. Someone who wants to do the right thing would come in and say, this is what we're doing, months before anything's public.
While the mayor sat in front of a church full of Penn Plaza residents in 2015 and promised the city would take a stand, Kevin Ackland was at a hockey camp with his kids in Minnesota. Ringside, he was on the phone all afternoon with the Gumbergs' lawyer.
What we were negotiating was removing, pulling the eviction notices, and slowing down the timeline.
Negotiations were just beginning. Pittsburgh City Hall is a stout granite number. It commands an entire block. In the summer of 2015, every Friday, shortly before 1 o'clock, the negotiators hurried to the elevators. They were all headed for the fifth floor and the mayor's conference room. It's a big room, hushed by floor-to-ceiling dark gray drapes. The city's namesake, William Pitt the Elder, hangs above the fireplace. He glares down his nose at a long oval table delivered to this room more than a century ago. Gail Williams raised the alarm about Penn Plaza. She and her daughter Lillian Great were usually first to the negotiation table.
We knew what we wanted because what the people wanted, what the people needed.
To get it, they had a lawyer on their side of the table, Kevin Quisenberry.
Litigation director for the Community Justice Project.
Kevin Quisenberry always has a pen in his shirt pocket. He rolls his sleeves above the elbow. A career's worth of housing cases gave him a very clear objective: head off a move or slow it down.
You know, if we have legal rights that are enforceable, we can help enforce those rights. Then we have to think, are there other levers?
Next, Larry Gumberg and his lawyer, Jonathan Kamen.
We understood that we had an opportunity that was otherwise really not available to anybody else.
Bustling in with papers and a can of Diet Coke, Kevin Ackland took the head of the table.
We felt like the most important thing and the priority, you know, was the people.
Finally, Bob Jamison, the chess player, sat next to Gail. Dressed to the nines, he observed each camp's opening move.
Everybody in there, I was reading. I'd read their body language, what they say.
In the beginning, it was like, we're going to see what they got to say, then we're going to shut them down.
The Gumberg camp made it clear pretty quickly that they were working on a tight timeline.
It was all business. I mean, I understand it's all business, but these are people's lives that you're messing with.
Larry came to the table to be a part of a solution, but he defended his project and his right to do it.
Pittsburgh's my hometown, too.
Kevin Ackland leaned on the Gumbergs to slow down.
We put all of our efforts into making sure that people weren't put on the street.
But Kevin Quisenberry wasn't ready to concede. Was development really the only outcome?
We're thinking about ownership. Is there, you know, an opportunity and a pathway, you know, for tenants to take ownership of this building?
The city offered to buy it. How much would it cost?
I think it was that we couldn't afford it, was the flippant response.
But Larry wanted something from the city, a change to what they could do with their land. They wanted to build a kind of retail that the existing land classification didn't allow.
Clearly, zoning is always leverage.
Bob watched the city and the developer posture, exchange bluffs.
That's the political game. We can make things hard for you. You know, we can make things hard for you.
Negotiations got tougher. Larry was rarely in the room, but his lawyer, Jonathan Kamen, represented their position. There's a photo of Kevin Ackland on his feet, pointing at Jonathan.
I once said I would rather just let this thing be a mud pit.
But Bob saw a point of attack.
You telling these people, and I'm one of the people, to just get up and move. Well, it takes money to just get up and move.
Some people were really bad off. Really. When I say really bad off, they were really bad off.
We had put on the table that they had to purchase like 3 years worth of, that the cash benefit of leaving was 3 years of rent.
That didn't fly with the Gumbergs.
And at first they wanted to just give you a couple of dollars, and now we raised the price up.
I'm letting you know I'm not stupid.
Very much of a hand-to-hand combat between City Hall and this developer.
And I would say stuff like, you're trying to get the people out the building, right? Put more money on the table.
After 10 weeks, Bob Jamison, Gail Williams, and Lillian Great brought a possible deal to their neighbors at Penn Plaza. The majority voted in favor. With their approval, the city, the Gumbergs, and the tenant council signed a memorandum of understanding. The Gumbergs promised to pay people in the first building $1,600 if they moved by February of 2016. They agreed to pay people in the second building $800 if they moved by the end of March of 2017. The city agreed to create a relocation assistance office for residents and to support the zoning change that the Gumbergs would need to actually do their development. They also laid out how the deal could support affordable housing in the area.
I thought it was fair. It moved the project along.
We basically got what we needed and wanted.
As far as the limitations, I think we did a good job. But we knew we couldn't take their building, and we couldn't stop them from tearing it down.
On September 28, 2015, the city of Pittsburgh issued a press release. It said the deal created, quote, a new standard for developments across Pittsburgh. It seemed to close a particularly divisive chapter in the city's history and chart a new path forward. Kevin Ackland says they did the best they could, but part of him wasn't so sure.
There's definitely a feeling of maybe we should have just gone to war.
Just as everyone thinks Penn Plaza is settled, a new group of people crack the deal wide open. Next time on Land and Power, the bureaucrats go rogue. Land and Power is a production of 90.5 WESA, reported and hosted by me, Margaret J. Krause. The show was edited and produced by Liz Reed. Production help from Katie Blackley, Kylie Kaczynski, and Sarah Kovash. Fact-checking by Sonu Babu, Patrick Doyle, Mary Rose O'Donnell, Isabel Schmeller, and Naomi Starobin. Special thanks to NPR's Story Lab team, including Uri Berliner, Nigeri Eden, Adelina Lansianis, Michael May, and Yowei Shaw. Thanks also goes to David Boylan, Chris Bream, Baina Brookins, Ricky Burgess, Randy Bush, and Frank Cunamondo. Kate Giamarisi, Nelson Harrison, Brian Izette, Chris Ivey, John Miller, and Larkin Page Jacobs. Lucy Perkins, Chris Potter, Ralph Proctor, Ellis Robinson, Jamie Wallace, and Mary Lee Williams. We've got photos of urban renewal in East Liberty, as well as David, Tom, Bill, Justin, Baina, and more at landandpowerpod.com.